The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello. Thanks for coming out on a rainy night. I really appreciate it. This is a homecoming for me. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I always dreamed I'd be able to come to a place, to Philadelphia Free Library and give a talk like this. And so I really appreciate you coming out. I'm going to talk to you about something called responsibility scores. Now, all of us have different numbers that are associated with us. We have our SAT scores. We might or might not know our IQ. We have grade point averages, and all of these scores tell people something about us. But then there's another score that's called the credit rating. And the credit rating is devised by the leading company that does this. It's called Fair Isaac, and they're out in California. They're north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And so I went to Fair Isaac, and I wanted to talk to them about how they understand credit and how they understand how risky each one of us is. Now, I should note that since I talked to them, they've screwed up a little bit on the credit on the risk assessments with finances. And but when I talked to them, I didn't know that this was going to happen. So they had this huge market for analyzing our financial behavior and various data that we produce, like how much debt we have and how much credit, how long it takes us to pay back our credit cards and things like that, to come up with this number. And it's a very important number because it can influence how much we pay for our mortgage or whether we can get a loan or not. But they wanted to expand their market. They said, maybe we can come up with something new called a responsibility score. Then if everybody had a responsibility score, just imagine what you could do with it. You could put it on job applications. You could brag about your high responsibility score. You could, maybe on dating services online, you could post your responsibility score right next to your picture. Maybe parents would want to know about somebody's responsibility score before they let their son or daughter go out with him or her. They thought there was this huge market, but then we sat around and we said, okay, how would we create, note that I'm with them thinking about this now, how would we create a responsibility score? What data about you would tell people or tell the machine that's analyzing each one of us how responsible we are? So we thought about it. We thought, I said, well, maybe if people's kids graduate from high school, would that be a sign that they're responsible? Yeah, but it kind of tilts a bit. It's not very fair because it tilts towards the rich. I said, how about certain medical procedures that you're supposed to get at certain ages? They said, well, that kind of data is not available to us, but it's a very good idea. So we kept on thinking about it, and we didn't come to any conclusions, but they thought this is a really promising market. And I just wanted to introduce this thought because I wanted each of you to start thinking about how these people that I call the numerati think. They're looking for bits of data that can predict what we are going to do. And they're looking in every realm of our lives. And though the responsibility score hasn't happened yet, it may one day. Now, I thought I'd tell you about how I came up with this idea for this book. I'm a writer at Business Week magazine, and we have this ritual at Business Week where you have a meeting once a month where you pitch cover story ideas. So I pitched the cover story, and the idea was that America's tech industry was in decline. I said, we're graduating fewer engineers and scientists. We're behind Europeans and the Japanese and the other Asians in broadband and wireless. And I laid out this whole idea about why our tech industry was facing likely decline and how important that was. And the editors all yawned. They said, that sounds like Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat. I said, yeah, but it's a really important story. And they said, well, can't you come up with a fresher way to talk about it? So one of the science editors said, you know, at the heart of all of these competitive issues is mathematics. And at that point, the editor-in-chief's eyes lit up, and he said, let's do a cover story on math. Nobody does cover stories on math. We can have a Business Week cover story, math. And people will buy it because it's so weird. And the science editor said, we have some people that know a lot about math who could do a good job on that story. And the editor-in-chief shook him off and said, no, let's get somebody less brainy to do it. So I was given the assignment of looking into the world of math. And I began calling up all these mathematicians. And I can tell you, nothing is more terrifying, not knowing a whole lot about math, than calling up the head of the math department at MIT and stammering through a list of questions. Well, you know, I know math is real. Can you tell me about some of the ways that math is really important? I mean, it was that stupid. Gradually, I began learning a little bit more and asking slightly more sophisticated questions. But after a month, I still didn't really have a very coherent idea of a story. I just knew a lot more about math. And so one day I went to IBM Research. And they had me lined up with different mathematicians every half hour. This was an exhausting ordeal for me. Starting at 9 or 10 in the morning, every half hour. And for lunch, I even had mathematicians for lunch. And in the middle of the afternoon, excuse me? Well, they talked with their mouths full, as I recall. In the middle of the afternoon, I sat down across from this mathematician who was the head of their stochastic analysis division named Samer Tikriti. He was born in Syria. And he told me about a project they had to harvest the data of 50,000 of their own workers, 50,000 consultants, and to build predictive mathematical models of each of these people, so that they could deploy these people as efficiently as possible around the world, put them each in a position where they would thrive with people that they would thrive with. So they would analyze everything they could. And at that point, I thought, well, if these IBM guys can quantify their colleagues, then other people who with the same skills can look at the rest of us as patients and as voters and as potential terrorists and as shoppers, and they can do the same thing to us using the same techniques, I'm sure. And so I thought I finally had my story. So I go to a phone later that day, or I pulled it out of my pocket, I guess it was, and I called up my former college roommate, who has a PhD in computer science, and he knows a lot more about any of this than I do. And I got his voicemail. And I was at the stage that's very common among journalists of, it's what I call ignorant euphoria. I didn't know a lot, but I had a really crystal clear idea, which was not yet fogged by intelligence or facts. So I raved into his voicemail. I said, I have the best story. This is the mathematical modeling of humanity. I said, this is the biggest thing. This is the biggest story of the century, really, because all of us are going to be modeled in so many different ways, and it's this huge laboratory of human behavior. And I went on and on, and I didn't hear back from him. So then I kept doing interviews, and I scheduled an appointment to see the chief scientist at Google. And I was out on the West Coast, and I was driving to the Google appointment when my phone buzzed in my pocket, and it was my college roommate calling me. And he said, I'm really worried about that story of yours. He explained to me about garbage in, garbage out. I'd heard about it before, but he really hammered the theme that if you have bad data, or data that's irrelevant, or you have data that's if you have built these models on misunderstandings or false ideas about people, then you're going to produce garbage. And he told me the story that probably some of you have heard about a drunk and a set of keys. The idea is that a guy walks out of a bar, and there's another man who's on his hands and knees under a lamppost looking for something. And the first guy says, "What are you looking for?" He says, "My keys. I lost my keys." And he says, "Where did you lose them?" And he points down a dark alley and says, "Over in that direction." And he says, "Well, why are you looking here?" And he says, "Because this is where the light is." And the idea is that these data hunters who I was saying are going to be modeling building the mathematical modeling of humanity would just as soon settle on what they could find rather than the more obscure truth that actually defined truth. And so, thus chastened, I went to Google. And I asked the chief scientist, Craig Silverstein, what he thought about the drunk, if he knew about him. He says, "Yeah, I, of course I know that story." And I asked him if it was important. He said, "Well, let me tell you a story. In middle school, I had a science fair project," he tells me. "And I came up with this fantastic data. And then I realized that the experiment was flawed. And so I had to come up with another experiment to hitch to the data that I had already produced. So I thought, well, if this Google guy had to create a false experiment to explain his data, then the mathematical modeling of humanity is going to take off first in industries where they can afford to get it wrong a lot. And I think that's true. The areas where this type of analysis, the analysis of our behavior, where it really takes off first and makes a lot of money for people, is in marketing and advertising. And those are two industries where you can afford to get it wrong and it's not that big a deal. Google's an example of that. I mean, you can laugh at the ads in Google that are irrelevant to what you're looking for. But if they get it right a fair amount of the time, they still do better than the previous status quo, and they can make a lot of money, as they've shown. So I went on and wrote my cover story, and I tried to add the nuance about the drunk and the key. And later I got this idea for the book, and I continued on. And the book looks at various ways in which we are understood by the analysis of our data. And the book follows this hunt for us as shoppers and voters, potential terrorists, patients, bloggers. And for some reason, I don't really know why, but the publisher really wanted me to add a chapter on lovers at the end, which I did. A lot of people are concerned. You know, I was on a radio show this morning, and the callers call in, and everybody is concerned about privacy and surveillance and the idea that the government or that these big corporations are going to be watching us, monitoring us, and trying to control our behavior. And I think it's all true, actually. I'm not going to deny that it's true. But much of the surveillance is self-inflicted. We allow people to watch us, or we even watch ourselves because it's convenient or because we think it's in our own best interest. I mean, if you think about those GM cars with the, OnStar that watches, you know, can trace where we go. And it's a lot of surveillance, but a lot of people sign up for that service because they feel safer. And if you think about the customer loyalty cards at the supermarket, again, we're giving people a lot of information about ourselves. We're telling them what we eat, but we're doing it in exchange for discounts. And again, we face these choices, and we often decide that we'll let people know. So a lot of it comes back to us. One of the areas where I'll give you an exaggerated example of the kind of surveillance that may be coming our way. I went out to Intel. Intel Corporation, they have operations in Portland, Oregon. And they think that there's this big growth market in monitoring people's medical conditions. And so they've wired the homes of scores of elderly couples with all kinds of sensors. And they're trying to measure everything they can about these people's lives, minute by minute, day by day. They're measuring the length of their strides as they walk through the house. They're measuring how they stand and how they shift their weight on the kitchen floor. They're measuring the strength of their voices and how long it takes them, how many milliseconds it takes them to recognize the voice of a loved one on the telephone. They're trying to establish what they call baselines, norms of these people's behavior, so that when they see a deviation, some kind of change from that norm, then they can infer that something is going on that they should be taking a closer look at. Eventually, they want to automatically have the machines automatically sift through this data and propose a diagnosis of what the people have. That's a long way off. Right now, a light would go on saying, whoops, look at this, there's a change. But eventually they want to be able to see whether people might be suffering from the first stages of Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, whether they're losing muscle mass in their legs and are at risk of falling. Most of us haven't lived under surveillance, this kind of surveillance, and so there aren't that many cases where they can point, where they figured something out early. But Michael J. Fox has Parkinson's disease, and these scientists, and he's one of the few in the world that has a week-by-week record in his sitcoms of his movement. And they have looked at his television shows from the 90s, and they can see in his strides and in his voice the first signs of Parkinson's disease, or so they claim. So it's really kind of pie in the sky, because they couldn't look at us and figure out we have Parkinson's at this stage. A lot of it is much more simple analysis that just says something's wrong. My parents were living in Portland, and my mother actually participated in this study. She participated in the cognitive thing. She'd go once every month or so and take these memory exams. But I remember thinking how it would have actually been useful for her to have been participating in this, because I was living in Montclair, New Jersey, and I had my parents, who were in their 90s by that point, in Portland, Oregon. And I remember going to the doctor in Portland, and they told my mother, who had congestive heart failure, that she should weigh herself every day and keep a record of her weight. Now, I went to the Sears nearby, and I bought her a scale. And the only kind of scale they had was this digital scale. And I came back knowing that this was going to be an absolute failure, because she had to remember to weigh herself every day, and I didn't think that was going to happen. To activate those digital scales, you have to put your weight on one leg and tap decisively with the other. She was well under 100 pounds at that point and not very steady on her feet, and so she wasn't going to be able to activate the scale. And if she had remembered to weigh herself and activated the scale, she wasn't going to be able to read the numbers of how much she weighed. So this was a data gathering nightmare. And Intel had these beds that they wire to weigh the people automatically every night. And I thought, well, that would be a good solution for my mother. But even so, sometimes the data can get kind of confusing. There was this one woman who climbed into bed and through the course of the night gained 8 pounds. And that, if you have congestive heart failure, they would be sending an ambulance over, because it means you're taking on liquids and you might be in really serious shape. It turned out that her dog had jumped on the bed. So, you know, they have a lot of work to do to figure this stuff out and to sort all these messy details of our lives and work them into their algorithms. But I think that what they're onto is something that we're going to be dealing with in our lives. which is the availability of these kinds of machines and this kind of surveillance and this kind of analysis. And, you know, you already see it in the auto industry. There's this company called Progressive Auto Insurance that offers you a discount if you put a black box in your car. And the black box will keep records of which neighborhoods you drive through, what time of day you're driving, which routes you take, how fast you accelerate, all kinds of things like that. And I've mentioned this before when speaking to people, and I say, how many of you would accept that deal, lower car insurance rates for a black box? How about you? Anybody here be willing to do that? One, two, three. Well, a lot of people say, not me, but my kid. And I think a lot of these technologies are actually going to be bought by people who are middle-aged, the sandwich generation, the people who are middle-aged now, and they're going to be imposed on their children and their parents. And then later, if they see that they work, then the population at large will embrace them. But it raises questions, because what if an insurance company calls you up and says, we'll give you a great deal on health insurance if you let our technician come over and install 3 or 4 or 5 different monitors? A lot of people naturally would say no, but then they say, well, you know, we think we could detect a stroke before you get it instead of after. Is that something you'd be interested in? Well, maybe. But, you know, what happens to your insurance policy if your patterns show that you are a high risk? Do they go up? We as a society have lots of questions to face about this. One of the things that is a constant with these people that I call the numerati, these people that analyze our data, is that they're looking at our behavior and not basing it on theory. Historically, we haven't had a lot of data about each other, and so we've had to go with theory. Sometimes the theory is just rank prejudice. It's based on, like, what kind of people are, what ethnic or racial group they're in, and we make blanket judgments about huge groups of people. We know that we're not right entirely. We know there's more nuance, but we don't have any other way to count and find the exceptions. Now they finally think they have a way to find the exceptions. And one of the areas where this is on display is in politics. What they want to do, the politicians, is find potential Democrats in Republican districts and potential Republicans in Democrat districts and swing vote. They want to find swing voters who might be open to an impassioned and very targeted plea. And so this one company that I looked at called Spotlight did a lot of research. They interviewed 4,000 people in great depth, and they asked them all kinds of questions that sound kind of pie in the sky, like, what are you scared of? What are your ambitions for your children? What are your feelings about your community? Define your community for me. Questions like that. And then they handed over the data to a corporate data analysis company called Yankelovich. And they said, go through this data and see if these people fall into any identifiable groups. So Yankelovich looked at it and said, oh, yeah, there are 10 groups here. And the 10 groups, on one side, there are these tribes, they call them, who are moved mostly by their ideas of what's righteous. And on the other side, there are people that are moved much more by their ideas of community. And in the middle, the people care most about what they call freedom. So then they had lots of records about these people. So they said, well, are there any political correlations to these groups? They said, of course there are. The righteous people are Republicans, the community people are Democrats, and the ones in the middle are up for grabs. And so they want to find those people that are up for grabs, and they want to find out what moves them, what they care about, so that they can target them. Now, this isn't something that they do it's very expensive, so they don't do it for everybody. They only do it in races where it's 49-51, very, very close races, where if you can find 10,000 people in Milwaukee or, you know, a few thousand people in Dade County or something, then you target them like this. But the question was, okay, now we know that the American people fit into these 10 tribes, but we only have counted 4,000 people. How about the other 200 million voters? How do we find them? So they said, we will look at the consumer data of these 4,000 people, and we will build models of them as consumers and using also some of their demographic data. And we'll build models, and then we'll go through vast databases and look at everybody else in the whole United States voting universe and assign them to one tribe or another. And so that's what they did. And now, if you are U.S. voters, I think just about everybody in this auditorium is a member of one or another of these tribes. And yet, you wouldn't recognize the other people in the tribe. They might not look like you. They might not live in the same neighborhood, eat the same food. But something unites you. Now they're not always right. They only get 3 out of 4. They only get us right 3 out of 4 times. But the other 25%, they say they're nearby tribes. So there was this one tribe called Barn Raisers. And this is 8% of the voting population, and they care deeply about right and wrong. Not that the rest of us don't, but these people really care about it. And the Barn Raisers are a swing group, and they voted 90% to 10% for President Bush 4 years ago. And yet in 2006, 50 to 60% of them voted for the Democrats in the congressional races. So this group said, well, the Barn Raisers are our swing vote that we really need to focus on. So they sold lists of Barn Raisers to the Obama campaign and different congressional campaigns in Florida, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, Indiana, and maybe one other state. And I don't know if it made a difference in this election or not, but this is something that they keep studying and working at, and they're going to be much more sophisticated 2 years from now, 4 years from now, and all of us are going to be placed in these various tribes that we don't even know exist. I went back to After I started working on the book, I went back to Samar Tekriti at IBM, the guy who had told me about how he was going to model 50,000 of his colleagues. And it's really easy when you're writing a magazine story. You write, IBM is going to build mathematical models of 50,000, and they're going to use them, to deploy them here and deploy them there, and it's going to be more efficient, and then you move on to something else. But when you do a book, you actually have to figure out how they're doing this. Like, how are you modeling these people? What do you do when you model a colleague? So I went to Tekriti and I asked him about this. And he told me the history of IBM. I don't know about if you know about in World War II, the German submarines, the U-boats, were sinking many of the boats in the convoys going from the United States to Britain. And it was crucial to the war effort to get those ships across the ocean. And they had to figure out how to organize the ships to increase their survival rate. Should you send them in small groups or large groups? How should the destroyers that guard them be deployed? They had all these questions that they didn't know. And so a group of mathematicians in Britain and the United States basically turned the entire North Atlantic theater into math, almost like a video game, and then began playing with different formations to see how they could most effectively move the ships across. And this was the birth of a science that's called operations research. And after the war, and it was successful, I should add. It was extremely successful. And after the war, IBM used this same science to try to organize, or what the word they use is optimize, its industrial supply chain so that they could move things in the most efficient way possible. And this science is alive and well today. Federal Express is a company entirely run by operations research. Most sort of logistical things are. The military really is. But so IBM reorganized its industrial supply chain, and then they sold that information to everyone else, and all these other companies organized their supply chains better. But IBM in the last 20 years has changed its business from industry to service. And so if they were to organize their industrial supply chain today, they'd have to do it to people. People are what they have to look. So they use the same science to try to organize their people better. And it's really crude. I mean, it's really crude. They don't really know us very well. But they're trying. And they're looking at data. And the important thing is, if they can figure out how to increase their productivity by 3%, that's huge for a company like IBM. And so even though I wouldn't say it's miraculous yet, they are organizing and deploying their people using these methods that were created to move machines around. And I think that at work, if you think about knowledge workers, a century ago, scientists went into factories and began measuring workers and organizing them so that they could, you know, they could work as efficiently as possible in auto plants and steel mills. And so industrial workers have been monitored and measured for a century, but they really couldn't figure out how to monitor and measure information workers until they got the computer. And now every keystroke and every mouse click that we produce at work belongs to our employers. And I think that as we head into what looks like a really painful recession, where every company is going to be trying to get as much productivity and cut costs as much as they can from the workforce, I think there's going to be a growth in surveillance and study of our behavior at work, so that they're going to try to optimize us at work. You know, one of the areas where I really had trouble getting interviews for this story was at the National Security Agency. But I had to do a chapter on terrorism. I mean, that's one area where data mining is being used extremely heavily, and you know, it's quite controversial. So I put in a call to the NSA, and I asked for an interview with their chief mathematician, and they said yes. And then the news broke that they had harvested all of this telephone and internet traffic, and it was an enormous scandal. And they called me up and said, "You know that interview that you wanted? Forget it." So I still had to deal with somebody who knew who could wrestle with the challenges of dealing with mountains and mountains of data. So I went out to Yahoo. Yahoo collects 2,500 bits of information about each of its 250 million users every month. So they've got information about us coming out of their ears. And I asked I talked to the chief of research there, and I said, "You know, what are the challenges of dealing with this much information?" He said, "Well, sometimes you can get too much data." And he gave me an example. Let's say that my credit card company sees that I bought a bottle of wine for $10 last night. It was red Portuguese wine, cost $10, and I bought it in Montclair, New Jersey, where I live. They, if they wanted, could say, "Let's look at everyone who bought red Portuguese wine in the New York metropolitan area and see what they have in common. This might be some kind of they might have some kind of something that we can market to all of them. We don't really know." So they look and they see there's me in Montclair. There's a guy in Clifton. There's, you know, maybe two people in the Caldwells. And 17 people in Newark, which is 10 miles to the south of us. So then they could spend a lot of time saying, okay, what do these people have in common? These guys in Montclair, the ones in Newark, do they have the same educational level? Do their houses cost about the same? Do they send their kids to public school? They could go into enormous amounts of detail as they try to find something that unites us besides red Portuguese wine. But if they thought about it more and if they knew more, they'd know that the guys in the Caldwells and me and the other guy in Clifton bought the wine because it was a $10 bottle of red wine, and the people in Newark are Portuguese. And so that fact that they're Portuguese is absolutely crucial, and the fact that it was Portuguese red wine led them on a wild goose chase. If you just said red wine, we would have had something in common, but the Portuguese was irrelevant and actually was counterproductive to them trying to understand what we were up to. So the NSA called up and said, you got that interview. So I go to this huge compound they have in Fort Meade, Maryland. It's surrounded with all kinds of electronic surveillance equipment, and they wouldn't let me in there. They have the mathematician come outside the compound and meet me at a museum of cryptology. It's a code-breaking museum. It's, you know, the guys that deciphered the Enigma code, and it was in the Cold War. We had all kinds of code wars with the Russians, and that's what the mathematicians were used for. So anyway, he sits down in the museum with me, and I'm a little bit awed by him because I'm afraid that if I get to the point about them and all this data they have about us and what kind of snooping they're doing about us, that he's going to get mad and walk out. So I begin the interview very gingerly, and I said, "This guy at Yahoo told me that sometimes." Sometimes you can have too much data. And is that true? He looked at me. He was kind of startled by the question. Then he said, well, the people at Yahoo might not know how to store the data, and they might ask it the wrong questions, and they might draw the wrong conclusions from the data. But no, you can never have too much data. So I found that a little chilling. About a couple months ago, this woman came into my office, and I work at Business Week, and I do a blog, and she told me that my blog was really, really poorly engineered. It wasn't properly calibrated to rise up on Google. I didn't have the right, I used humor in my headlines. The machine doesn't appreciate humor. I didn't use the same words often enough in the first couple sentences. The machine wants repetition of words. It appreciates that. I didn't link enough. She had a long list of things that I was doing wrong. And for that reason, my blog wasn't climbing up high enough in Google, and I wasn't getting enough hits on my blog. Now, this is something, an entire industry has grown to help people calibrate their web pages so that they can rise up in Google. It's called search engine optimization. It's an entire field of consulting now. And the fact is that as a company, you need to make your case to a machine so that other people can find you. If that machine doesn't appreciate you or doesn't appreciate the way you've organized your thoughts or your words, you are not going to be found. And I think this is true for the rest of us, not only those of us who are dealing with blogs and web pages, but increasingly, as the numerati gain power over entire industries, we are going to be making our case to machines that we would be good employees, that we would be good dates, that we would be good students. There are many things, many cases where we're going to have to make our case to the machine. And to do that, we're going to need to hone our own algorithms. We have to basically figure out what the machine's looking for and provide it. Now, this kind of thought process is not new to us. Those of us who tried to get into college, knew a long time ago what Smith was looking for or what Yale was looking for and tried to satisfy them. So humans do this. This is our nature. We figure out systems and we game them. But all I'm saying is now the systems are going to be run by machines, and we're going to need to understand their thought processes or the thought processes of the people who programmed them. And perhaps nowhere is this truer than in the world of dating. I convinced my wife to do a little experiment with me. I told her that we could both sign up for chemistry.com, which has extremely advanced algorithms, and that if the numerati at chemistry.com were doing their job, that service would find us and find us for each other. There was only one trouble with this. Maybe the service was right and our marriage was wrong. So that was a little hole in my logic. But anyway, I thought I'd try it out. So we both signed up for chemistry.com and filled out these long applications. And my wife was very unhappy about this whole process. And we hit the enter button, and they went off into the chemistry.com computers, and we waited to see if we'd show up in each other's lists. And we waited, and we waited, and we saw other people, and we didn't see each other. And they were lining up. They had me lined up with some pretty interesting people, I have to say. But they lined my wife up with some of these. I couldn't believe what they were doing. They had her lined up with this guy who lived on the far side of Kennedy Airport. Now, we live in Montclair. To get to Kennedy Airport, I wouldn't even go through. Just long story short, hour and a half of hell to get from Montclair to Kennedy Airport. And so this guy would have to be unbelievable. And I just couldn't understand why he was so superior to the Steve who lived in Montclair, who even, as luck would have it, lived in the same house. So I began questioning what maybe I'd made a mistake. So I looked carefully at the data that I had provided their service, and I saw that I had made one tiny, almost insignificant oversight. And it had to do with age. You wouldn't believe what a cad people in Montclair think I am. Believe me, I'm not that bad, but it had to do with age. And I fixed it, and I adjusted it, and my wife, in a digital sense, fell right into my arms. And that was our experiment with chemistry.com. And I have to say that I think the numerati are going to have so much influence over our lives in the world of shopping and dating. I mean, not dating, shopping and in healthcare, and there's all kinds of concerns about the battle against terrorism, which I'd be happy to, answer questions about that. But I think love at this point is still a stretch for them. But I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any about the book or about my research. If you just have to, the only condition is you have to wait for a microphone. Yes.
First, a comment. You may remember that when the term artificial intelligence was big 10, 15 years ago, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker where two mathematicians walk along, and one said, where there is artificial intelligence, there must also be artificial stupidity. So that's just a remark. But I've always felt that these data that people, that companies collect are really our own property. It would seem to me that they should pay us for that. And I think if they did, more people would be willing to supply the data. And I don't know why the thought that these data belong to us rather than to them doesn't occur to anybody.
I think it will after people read my book.
Okay.
I really do. I mean, I think that what you say, I agree entirely with that. And I think what's going to happen is that we as a society are going to grow much more aware of the value of our data, the importance of our data, and how it can be used. And we are going to start demanding some accountability from the companies that use it. And that companies are going to – this is a great opportunity for companies, because if they can show us that they're trustworthy – and can give us good services for in exchange for our data, we're going to pick a handful of companies and give them a whole lot of data. And in exchange, we're going to expect them to respect it, respect our privacy, and give us great customized service and products. And the rest of the companies, those that don't earn our trust, they're going to be in this low world, in the same world as spammers are today. We're not going to trust them. And so it's going to be very important for companies to pass this test, I think. Yes, back there.
My question is, do you foresee any use for the numerati as forces of good? In the book, it seems, you know, dating, terrorism, yes. A lot of the data mining for companies, not so good. They're changing our consumer purchasing habits. But are there any humanitarian efforts that you could foresee using their techniques?
Well, I think in the area of medicine, there are great opportunities for it. There's a big privacy issue. We have to figure out how to handle our data and respect our privacy and anonymize our data so that researchers can benefit from knowing about us without knowing too much about us. But I think there's great potential in medicine. And I think also just in logistics of how societies are deployed, like in the third world or even in parts of this country that aren't organized very well, I think these people are going to be able to see, basically optimize us as a society. In the battle to lower our dependence on fossil fuels, we have a transportation system that is optimized for freedom and way, way down for efficiency. And I think that I think by being smarter about it and learning more about our patterns as we move around, we can dramatically cut our use of fossil fuels. Yes.
Do you know why Progressive Insurance Company wanted that data from those black boxes, number one? And number two, is there anything that would stop them from selling that data?
Well, I don't know what the contract – I didn't see the contract. I would imagine that the contract would stipulate that they couldn't sell that data. Otherwise, I think they'd be facing big public relations and perhaps legal problems. But they'd want the data because all of these companies – that are trying to gauge our risk benefit from more knowledge of our behavior so that they can understand us better and calibrate the risk. But, you know, it really brings into question one of the basic, the fundamental truth of the insurance. The insurance industry is based upon a level of shared ignorance. We don't know what our risks are. And so those of us who are healthy or those of us who are good drivers subsidize those who are less healthy and more reckless drivers. And as we produce more and more of this digital data and they can understand us better as individuals, it brings into question the whole future of the insurance industry, I think. Yes.
Insurance industry thing. I don't know if everyone here is aware of the fact that there are cameras at dangerous intersections now that take pictures of people's license plates.
Yes.
Those were installed in Philadelphia after John Street became mayor, and they were installed, although he would never admit it, because he was a captive of the insurance and the banking industry. And what most people, I think, don't know is that those cameras aren't paid for or maintained by the government. They're paid for and maintained by insurance companies, which gather and harvest the data and charge you points when they've caught you for speeding. So those little cameras more than pay for themselves, and insurance companies put them in all over the place because they make a ton of money on them.
Right.
And so that's one thing I'd like you to comment about. But about this thing about harvesting the data, I don't think there is a good company and a bad company, because the information spreads like a virus. You give it to one company who will sell it to another company or trade it, and even though they say that they won't, and it winds up, you know, seven levels away, and you have no idea the fact that it's gotten there. And this stretches through every facet of society. There was a story in the paper today about the Robinsons in Princeton and their bequest being dishonored, and it's just all over. So I don't know why anyone should assume that there are any good companies.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess if the press is doing its job and we find out about those things, companies pay a certain price in public relations and distrust. But, I mean, I don't really know.
He had the first question about the surveillance of the cameras.
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not familiar with that case of the surveillance of the insurance companies paying for surveillance cameras, but
all over the country.
Surveillance cameras are, you know, London is the most heavily surveilled city in the Western world. The Chinese are busy trying to catch up. I mean, if you have a society that is scared of something, then you have a good reason or a good excuse, you could say, for installing more machinery to keep an eye on people. And I think people generally, if they're given what you might consider a false choice between security and privacy, a lot of people opt for security. And you know, that's going to be a political debate we have, I think. But it's going to grow. It's going to keep growing. Yes, way back there.
I just thought I'd mention that I work for a company that does the exact opposite of what you're mentioning. Basically, I data mine companies to see what they're using for their identity. We work basically, I spend all day just coming up with mounds and mounds and databases of information, just to figure out what trends are going on with companies, how these people are naming themselves, what they're using to keep themselves prevalent in people's minds. And I was wondering if you had any comments on that or if you were aware of that. It's not common practice in most companies.
Okay, so how does your company make money?
Yeah.
I can't really talk too much about it. I signed a non-disclosure, but basically it's deals with advertising. It deals with product, just basically people will approach us because they know we have something that they need that will, like, a right to something, basically. It's almost like the dot-com boom. It's very similar to that.
Okay. I'd like to do a Business Week story about that. But
I wish I could, but I'd probably get fired for it. But I just thought I'd mention to you that it is out there. There are companies that are doing this.
And, yeah. I mean, excuse me? Yeah. I, you know, one of the chapters in the book talks about companies that are that have taught computers to automatically read millions of blog posts every day and calculate the age, the gender, and the opinion of the blogger about a certain subject or another. And so this is a way of monitoring human discourse, looking for different consumer trends and marketing trends. And right now, it's extremely crude because they only can kind of give a thumbs up, thumbs down. This person didn't like the Coke commercial. This person liked it. But as this science becomes a little bit more sophisticated in the next 10 years, I think they're going to come up with a much more nuanced understanding of everything that we write and put online. So that's going to be a ton more very heavily contextual data about us and what we're up to. Okay, back there.
This might be a little naive, but setting the privacy aside, have you noticed that there's more reluctance or pushback from just the fact that it's, in a sense, unromantic, that, well, I don't really mind that my information is out there, that people are being used for it, but it kind of interferes with my sense of individual as opposed to just a set of numbers. Is that something that you've encountered Numerati is actually thinking about, trying to maybe forestall that pushback that probably will happen as we become better at individualizing these data sets?
Well, you know, a lot of people, when I tell them about my book or my research, they say, we're all being treated like numbers. And we have been treated like numbers for a century. You know, if you look at armies in the First World War running into machine gun fire, those were just numbers falling, and they were indistinguishable one from the other. And what these people would say in their defense is, hey, no, we're not looking at people as numbers. We're looking at them as extraordinary, complex combinations of numbers, and each individual is being respected as an individual for the first time in history by machines. Now, I don't know if that comforts you at all. The other point that I'd make is that I think one of the dangers of the Numerati is that they reinforce what we've already done. And what is most likely to change us is something and really open our eyes or give us a unique experience is something we've never done and something we'd never dream of doing. And they're really bad at that, you know? And so you lose some serendipity and some of that magic in these formulas, I think. Especially in the early stages. Maybe somebody will come up with a great serendipity algorithm. Yes.
I'm interested in what you found out at Google, since Google has more data than I think any other company on us. What are they planning to do with that data, and what kinds of categories are they organizing it in?
Well, Google talked to me when I was researching the Business Week story, but when I was researching the book, they didn't talk to me. They didn't return my phone calls. I ended up doing all my Google-type research over at Yahoo, which was the best I could do in that valley. It's really hard to answer your question about what they would want to do. They are basically insatiable, and they want all the data that they could possibly imagine. And they want. I was talking to the CEO of Google when I was working on another story after I wrote the book, and he said, "Just imagine all these cameras in the world. We could have the whole world beamed up live video." That's happening right now in the whole world. And so they've got fantastic ambitions. He told me, you know, by 2025, which is only, 16 years away, you're going to have a machine like an iPod that is going to have 80 years of high quality digital video in it. So you're going to have more video on you than you'll be able to watch in the rest of your life. So there's just going to be so much data that, this thing has just begun. And I'm sorry I can't give you great details on what Google's precise ambitions are, but they're grandiose. I think, is that about it? Well, thank you so much. I'd be happy to talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.